Welcome to this Nederland Community Library recording of one of our programs. To find more programs, visit nedlib.org.
So as Electra said, I'm a professor at the University of Colorado. I've taught there since 2009. I first started going to, most of my connections are in Russia. But I really want the focus to be on Ukraine today. But most of my personal connections and professional connections are in Russia. I started going to Russia in 2002. That's when I first studied abroad there as an undergrad, and then kept going back while I was working on my PhD at Ohio State. And since 2002, I really went every year or two, and then lived there for stretches of time in Moscow. I didn't go during the pandemic. I was supposed to go back this year, and that of course is not possible right now for me. But I will be talking mostly about Ukraine and then come back at the end to talking about what Russians think about this. I know we don't have really a very large group, and so really I want this to be of interest and useful to you. So if you'd like to interrupt me, I'm very comfortable being interrupted. I do not mind at all. So I'm happy to make this more of a conversation. Like Electra said, I do have a lot of slides up here. I can't help myself as an academic and as a professor. I have a lot of slides and information, but I'm happy to go off of that and to skip through things if they're not of general interest or if it's too much background, then I'm
Sarah?
Happy to go through that. Yes.
We already have a question. Someone asked if there's anybody in the audience that has a Ukrainian background.
Oh, does anyone have a Ukrainian background? Yes, we do have some people in the audience that have a Ukrainian background. That's an easy question to answer. Thank you for being here. Also, that link there, it'll be on the next slide as well. All the slides are there. Slava Ukraina, glory to Ukraine in Ukrainian. I don't speak Ukrainian, unfortunately. I speak Russian, but that's Slava Ukraina. You can see all the slides there as well. I'm happy to email that to you afterwards too. So today, my plan for what to talk about was first to talk a bit about Ukrainian democracy after communism, to give a background for the current conflict and how we got here. Of course, the history of this conflict goes back much further. I told someone I was doing this event and I was going to talk about the roots of the conflict in 2013, and they said, "You can't do that. You have to go back hundreds of years. This is much older than that." And it is. They're absolutely right. But I'll be focusing on the post-communist period and talking about Ukraine after communism. My three main points today are all in this slide if I lose you later on. So Ukrainian politics has been deeply divided, deeply polarized. There have been endemic problems with corruption, but there's also been competitive elections in the period after communism, and a shift towards Europe away from Russia, although that's been contentious. Then I'll talk directly about Russia's war against Ukraine in 2022 and what's been happening only for two months and six days maybe. It really has not been very long, but has upended the world order in that time and upended all of Europe. And this will not go away anytime soon. And then what Russians think about the war, which, to give you a preview, is that despite the fact that there were protests, despite the fact that there were thousands of people that left the country, it's a country of 143 million. So thousands leaving is noticeable, but it's not a huge mass exodus. Despite that vocal minority of opposition early on, that has mostly quieted down in Russia. And most Russians, more than 50%, do actually support what Russia's doing in Ukraine, in part because they're seeing an alternate reality of an explanation of what's going on. They are not seeing the same news that people see in Europe or that people see really anywhere else in the world. And so I'll talk about that. I'll start with Ukrainian democracy after communism, and I'll try not to go on too long about this because I want to get to talking about the war. And so, of course, after communism ends, we now refer to Ukraine, not the Ukraine, although that's a very hard habit to break because people were really used to referring to what's happening in the Ukraine. But because it's not a region and it's a sovereign country, we now refer to what's happening in Ukraine, not the Ukraine. you'll have noticed these are just minor points, but I thought they might be of interest. Kyiv, K-Y-I-V, is the Ukrainian, is transliterated from Ukrainian. Kiev, K-I-E-V, is transliterated from the Russian spelling. And this seems like a really minor point, I know, and a minor point to begin on, but I don't think it's minor if you're from the country. And I don't think it's minor if you're Ukrainian, because there is this long legacy of Russia subsuming Ukraine and kind of trying to make it part of the Russian Empire and part of a Russification, the Ukraine, and sort of a belittling, frankly, of Ukrainian culture. So I think it actually is significant to note the correct spellings here. You'll see a variety of spellings, two really mainly, of Zelensky's name. The double Y is based on the Ukrainian spelling. The single Y is based on the Russian spelling and how it has been spelled for a long time in Western media. The New York Times is still using the single Y. Some news agencies have switched to the double Y. The Zelensky with the IY is another way to transliterate it from the Russian. So that's why you'll see a variety of those spellings in relation to Ukraine. If we look at a timeline of Ukrainian democracy after communism, so this is significant because of Putin's historical fiction about Ukraine and whether or not it should be part of Russia. Ukraine has been independent from the Soviet Union since the Soviet Union ended, which officially on January 1st, 1992, it no longer existed as a country. And then we have the first big period after communism is Leonid Kuchma, was the first president. He had 2 5-year terms. And this is a period of deep political polarization. There's a lot of corruption. There's the rise of business people that would be called oligarchs, these really powerful, wealthy business people that profit from the privatization of formerly owned state property. And it's a turbulent period. There's some analogies between the Kuchma period in Ukraine and the Yeltsin era in Russia in the 90s, and that there's these very imperfect market reforms happening. There's deep political polarization and corruption. Governance is not ideal, to say the least, but it's competitive elections. It's like messy democracy, right? So it's democratic, it's sovereign, it's independent. It's very much not perfect. And when Kuchma comes to the end of his time in power, he's serving his second 5-year term in 2004, he wants to pull what Yeltsin did. He wants to handpick a successor who will be sort of from his side that will take over the presidency. And he attempts to do this by selecting Yanukovych to be sort of his backed candidate in the election. And so you have Yushchenko and Yanukovych running in presidential elections. Initially, Yanukovych wins, but there's mass protests. That's the Orange Revolution that happens. The results are overturned and Yushchenko comes to power. So Yushchenko comes to power. In the West, this was really portrayed as this is a pro-democracy grassroots movement. They've kicked out this leader who Yanukovych did try to cheat to win in the 2004 election. They've gotten rid of him. Yushchenko's there. He's the pro-Ukrainian candidate. An O on the end of the name typically, not always, but typically indicates an ethnically Ukrainian name. Often, and the Yanukovych is a clearly ethnically Russian name. So this is also corresponds to the more pro-Europe and the more pro-Russian candidate. So Yanukovych did try to cheat. There were mass protests. They rehold the election. Yushchenko comes into power and he gets 5 years, but Yushchenko's taking over under less than ideal circumstances. And Yushchenko serves, he comes in with the Orange Revolution. There's Yanukovych, Party of the Regions. This is Yushchenko. When he's running in 2004, he gets poisoned and almost dies. Almost certainly, either directly or indirectly, I don't think it's been definitively settled, but Yanukovych probably tried to kill him, or Yanukovych's security forces. So you can see there's this famous poisoning case. He gets poisoned. He almost dies. He doesn't die. And then he wins the election, which is all of this is, I mean, you could not write a stranger or more turbulent political period in Ukraine. So it's Yanukovych there versus Yushchenko. Yulia Tymoshenko is also a very famous politician from this time, and she's in the Rada in the legislature today. Tymoshenko serves for a time as the prime minister for Yushchenko. They're the Para movement. which is the, like, Our Time Is Now movement. And she's later imprisoned by Yanukovych because he'll come into power later. It gets complicated, the timeline. But that's Yanukovych's party. Yeah, so it's that side versus this side. And so Yushchenko does win, but takes over under not great circumstances and only after there are these mass protests with the Orange Revolution. And for a long time, that was the big news in Ukrainian politics. It was one of these color revolutions in the region where mass protests about electoral fraud overturned a fraudulent election and you got another leader in power. I would like to put this up because what you can see, I think pretty clearly here in 2004, is that Ukraine has, in the entire post-communist period, has always been deeply polarized and divided. And this is a bit simplistic, but it is pretty accurate that the Western part of the country has favored moving towards Europe with trade agreements and political agreements and culturally, and the Eastern part of the country has been more on the side of let's do business with Russia and has more native Russian speakers and more ethnic Russians. And so if we look even back to 2004, that yellow orange part, that's all where Yushchenko won a majority. And the blue part is all where Yanukovych won a majority. So it was a very close election in which Yanukovych did try to cheat. There were mass protests and Yushchenko comes to power, which in the West they described as an unmitigated good thing, right? This was who should have been elected. And it probably was. Yushchenko should have democratically won the election and ends up doing it. But the way they had set up political institutions in Ukraine is that it was very winner take all. The president gets to appoint all the governors of regions. So you get the presidency, you get it all. And so the stakes are really high for getting the presidency in Ukraine. And this is part of the reason there's a big incentive to make sure you win at all costs, because it's going to affect the entire country. And that probably was not an ideal scenario to set up. It's a bit hard to explain for me, at least, in that. So traditionally, Ukrainians and Russians do not have ethnic tension. This is not to say, though, that historically, of course, there are big notable moments like the famine in Ukraine in the Soviet period where Stalin starves, millions of people die. And that's something that's in many ways done by Russians to Ukrainians. Right, but the language politics could be contentious in the Rada, but lots of people speak Russian and Ukrainian and they go back and forth a lot. It's not like the former Yugoslavia, where there's this legacy in a different way of long-term, like religious and language differences and cultural. Ukrainians and Russians are distinct ethnicities and distinct languages, but they're both Slavic languages. They're both Orthodox Christians, although the churches have split. And so there are a lot, what I'm saying is it's not motivated by an ethnic conflict. It's going to become one and it is becoming one, but it was not inherently an ethnic conflict that had to exist as an ethnic issue, even though we see this divide here, right? So it's, some people thought Ukraine was on the brink of civil war from the time it became an independent country because of this divide and because of the way they set up political institutions with this very winner take all. You get the presidency, you kind of get everything. So that's the Orange Revolution in Maidan Nezalezhnosti, which is Independence Square. And I've been to Kyiv once, and it's Maidan Nezalezhnosti. The fact that they sustained this in the Orange Revolution, protests this big for weeks, is astonishing that they were able to. It's a huge square. I mean, that's a huge swath of territory and place to have protesters camped out for weeks. And that's in the Orange Revolution. So that brings us through we have the Orange Revolution. Yushchenko serves the presidency, but Yushchenko, who Yanukovych tried to kill, remember, because they also have a semi-presidential system where they have a president and a prime minister that have to govern together, because what's better than one boss is two bosses, right? No, not really. Yushchenko has to appoint Yanukovych as his prime minister for a period of time. That's how bad it is in Ukraine in that period. And this is he had to appoint as his prime minister someone who tried to kill him during the election and tried to steal the election. And he only got in because there were mass protests. And so not a lot gets successfully done in the Yushchenko period, that presidency. Yanukovych is prime minister for a period. because that's the only person he could get approved by the Rada. The Rada, the legislature has to approve the prime minister. Timoshenko, who I showed before, she has these really iconic braids that she wore for a long time, was Yushchenko's prime minister for a period, but he serves these 5 years. They don't go great. Not really for his fault. the odds were very much against him. The next election, Yanukovych wins. There are accusations of problems, but it's entirely plausible that Yanukovych fairly won. And now we're getting really close to the current crisis. So it's 5-year terms for the presidency in Ukraine. And you'll notice that Yanukovych is only in power for 3. So in 2013, in the fall, Ukraine was very close to signing an EU trade agreement with the EU, not joining the EU. They just were going to sign a trade association agreement, which meant they would have some preferential status and could do more business with the EU. Yanukovych plays this along and plays this along. He's getting counteroffers from Russia for different economic and trade packages, and he's playing that against the EU trade association agreement that's being negotiated at the same time. But it looks like he's going to sign the EU deal. And at the last minute, he pulls out. And then you get the Euromaidan protests. So the Euromaidan protests are the most direct origin of the current crisis. When we have the Euromaidan movement in November 13, so we see the protests start in November 13 against Yanukovych pulling out of this trade agreement. There's mass protests, but unlike the Orange Revolution, where they allowed the protests to happen and they were sustained, Yanukovych says, no, we're not having any of this. We're calling out the Berkut special police forces and we're shooting people. And that's what they did. They killed dozens and dozens of people. They arrested them. They tortured them. It was awful in 2013, what Yanukovych was doing. And yet, because Ukrainians are exceptionally brave, people kept protesting with the Euromaidan movement. They saw the stakes as, we're going towards Europe or Russia, which the fact that those were the stakes is already telling, right? And we're gonna stay in the streets. Now, you did have more resistance to that in eastern Ukraine, where we're going to see separatist regions that will be backed by Russia. And Crimea was largely ethnically Russian, and they were more on the pro-Russia side. But so we see mass protests, we see a harsh crackdown. Was there a question on Zoom?
No, okay. There's no
other
questions on Zoom.
Okay. Yanukovych ends up fleeing to Russia. And this is where Putin is very likely, I mean, I can only imagine when Yanukovych is forced to flee the country, Putin is likely beside himself angry at this point, because Putin's goal has always been to both interfere with and control Ukrainian politics, always, for the entirety of the 2000s, to varying degrees. And so Yanukovych flees and goes to Russia. Russia takes that opportunity to say the Ukrainian government is oppressing ethnic Russians in Crimea and eastern Ukraine. That is made up, almost entirely made up. And so we need to intervene. There were separatist regions in Donbass, Luhansk and Donetsk, which are probably regions you've heard of if you follow the conflict at all. So Russia invades Crimea full scale and has taken it over since then. They do that in 2014. Yeah, they did. Little Green Men is how they start to be called, the Little Green Men. And at first, Russia says, Putin just lies. He just says, no, we're not there. Our forces aren't there. No one's there. That's from Russia. And they're like, really? Then it turns out they were. They were there all the time. They sent soldiers who were not in uniform to the regions, who both helped the separatist regions become larger movements and be successful, and helped take over Ukraine. Crimea at the time. So Crimea is illegally acquired by Russia, and Russia has actually set up administration in Crimea. They hold a referendum in 2014 where they have an odd set of options on the referendum. The options are like, you can become your own state or you can become part of Russia, but there's no option to stay with Ukraine. And they let Russian soldiers who were stationed in Crimea vote. So it's not the best referendum ever. But it is likely that in any case, most ethnic Russians in Crimea probably did support joining Russia, even though that referendum was nonsense. the reason Crimea is mostly ethnic Russians is because in Soviet times, Stalin deported the Crimean Tatars to Central Asia. Many of them died, not all of them, and put ethnic Russians in Crimea. So I mean, the reason that it's like they put Russians there and then later claimed that Russia should have it because Russians were there, which is, I mean, if you're going to come up with historical fantasies, that's it's an odd kind of route to go. Yeah. But Russians were hugely supportive of taking over Crimea. They'd always seen it as part of Russia. Crimea was actually in Soviet times part of the Russian Republic for a long period of time. And then under Khrushchev, they transferred the administration to the Ukrainian Republic within the Soviet Union. And they said, well, we wouldn't have done that if the Soviet Union was going to collapse. And it's like, well, no, but you did. And so when Ukraine becomes independent, they let Crimea be part of sovereign Ukraine. But many Russians felt like Crimea should have always been part of Russia and were hugely supportive of that. I don't personally think that's right that Russia overtook Crimea, but I think it's tremendously unlikely Ukraine gets it back anytime soon. I think is a very, very sad reality. So this is when all the fighting begins. And this is when the fighting begins in eastern Ukraine. So this has been a war for 8 years. It's been going, and eastern Ukraine has been controlled by the separatist regions. Russia hasn't set up administration there. Donetsk and Luhansk are largely run by, it's not an exaggeration to say warlords, I mean, that are running the territory. These are not elected people that can be held accountable for things. Social services are awful if existent at all. So you hear lots of stories about people crossing the border from Donbass into western Ukraine to collect their pensions, to go to school, and other things if they can. I'll go through this quickly because this is, I think, pretty redundant at this point. We have the Euromaidan movement, Yanukovych leaves, and then they put his opulent palace as they make it a tourist attraction. He had his own peacocks. He had toilets made of gold. I mean, all the kinds of ridiculous things you do, I guess, if you are very corrupt. So that's the whole timeline we're looking at. After that conflict happens, so Yanukovych flees, they have an interim government. They elect Poroshenko from the first 5 years. The Poroshenko period doesn't go great. The odds are stacked against him again. There's high corruption. There's a conflict in the eastern part of the country. And so Poroshenko does not win re-election. Zelensky does, which, I mean, I think most of you probably know now, Zelensky is a comedian. He's a little bit like, I mean, I don't want to take this too far. It's like the Stephen Colbert of Ukraine or something. It's like, because he did political satire in part. He has a show they've brought back to Netflix called Servant of the People, where he plays a school teacher who becomes the president of Ukraine, and was used as a commentary on Ukrainian politics. And so Zelensky was high profile, but hadn't been in politics before. And he gets elected with a pretty solid mandate. He wins more than 40% of the vote, which is very good for a presidential round. So he's got a mandate to start. He has a very bumpy start. Of course, the pandemic happens. People aren't happy about how that's handled. He's got the Donbass conflict. He's still trying to crack down on corruption. But he's elected in a free and fair election. And so that brings us up to 2022, I think. And I'm not keeping an eye on my time, so maybe Electra can cut me off if I'm going too long. So Russia invaded just a couple months ago, on February 24th, 2022. One big question is why did they do this then? And I really wish I had a complete answer for that. I have a partial one. The partial answer is that, and what Russia has said, is they're worried that Ukraine would join NATO. That was not even on the table. No one was talking about Ukraine joining NATO, though. It was not even being negotiated. Russia wanted to prevent the possibility that Ukraine ever thought about joining NATO. And so they wanted NATO to say that they would never let Ukraine in preemptively before anything happened, which NATO was not going to do. They also didn't want Ukraine to join the EU, but there were no EU negotiations going on at the time. They said that the violence against ethnic Russians in Donbass had reached a high level. They very falsely claimed that there was a genocide against ethnic Russians in Donbass and Luhansk and Donetsk. There is not evidence of that. And they have made all kinds of fantastical claims about the Ukrainian government being run by neo-Nazis. Zelensky is Jewish, which I don't even think is the most important component of why that conspiracy theory is stupid. They've got a Jewish president. There are neo-Nazis in Ukraine. That is not disputed. But they don't run the government. And there wasn't any evidence of that. And so the Russian government really kind of fabricated this after 8 years of conflict, the reason to go in. And the US and British governments were both saying, we can see them massing troops on the border. And Russia saying, no, 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 military exercises. We're not going in. We're not going in. And then they invaded, which is the same thing they did in 2014 when they said, no, no, there's no Russian soldiers there. There's no Russian soldiers. And then a couple months later, they make this documentary to air on Russian TV that's like, look, we saved Ukraine. And so there's a lot of questions about why the Russian public buys this. But this is what's happened in the past couple months. And so Zelensky and his government have, I think, remarkably, very bravely stayed in Ukraine, stayed in Kyiv. Russia somehow has not been able to capture, was not able to capture the capital, which I find very surprising. Many people, myself included, did not think Russia would follow through on invading the entire country of Ukraine because it would destroy their country and Ukraine's, which it has, and it didn't make any sense. But they did. And once they did, many people, myself included, thought they'll absolutely be able to take the capital. It's just a matter of time. But the Russian army was so underperforming and the Ukrainian army so overperforming that it's not that the Ukrainian side's won, but they have done a remarkable job holding off the Russian forces for the time being. And so Russia now is focused on the eastern part of the country. They're back to focusing on Donbass. You've probably heard a lot about Mariupol, where they are starting to evacuate civilians finally from the city. But they stayed. And so this has caused an enormous humanitarian crisis. I know that I think Ben has more information about the fundraiser, the sunflower seeds for Ukraine, probably at the end. The humanitarian crisis, if the war ended today, there would be a need for tremendous amounts of humanitarian crisis, and it's not going to end anytime soon. They're going to keep fighting in eastern Ukraine for an extended period of time. So at least 5 million Ukrainians have fled the country. The UN is estimating 8 million by the end of the year. Most of those are women and children because they passed a law that men from 18 to 60 could not leave the country because they were expected to stay and fight for Ukraine. 7.7 million displaced within the country. There's been at least 2,729 Ukrainian civilian deaths recorded by the UN. The mayor of Mariupol, which you'll see on a map in a moment, claims that 10,000 civilians have been killed. I don't know that that's been verified, but that seems plausible to me, given what's going on there. We have cases like Bucha, where it's very, very clear that Russian forces indiscriminately killed civilians. Although, don't worry, the Russian Ministry of Defense announced that Russian soldiers weren't there when that happened, and the Ukrainians did that to themselves. Which seems really plausible as an explanation, not at all, but this is what the Russian government is saying. So targeted killings of civilians, and the Russian government is also lying about the number of Russian soldiers killed. British intelligence and NATO intelligence have said that it's probably about 15,000 soldiers, which is a huge number. I think that's more than twice what the US lost in the whole time in Afghanistan or something. And Putin initially claimed they weren't sending conscripts to, which of course, then the Ministry of Defense said, no, we are. And then Putin said, well, we better find who didn't obey my orders not to send conscripts. But they don't have enough people in the army to not send conscripts, especially if the conflict continues. So there's all kinds of reports of them looking for mercenary soldiers, soldiers for hire that they can send in. What's devastating about this is there are conscripts there. So these are 18, 19-year-old kids that did not know what they were getting into. So the Russian family I've known since 2002, Andrei was a baby when I first went to Russia in 2002, and he's almost 20 now, and he's in the Russian army. And so, I mean, he wasn't in Ukraine yet, but this is something that I think about constantly because it's not that I'm in any way sort of on Russia, I'm not on the pro-Russia, pro-war side in this, but there are just layers and layers of tragedy here, of people that are being killed and places being destroyed for no reason whatsoever, that needs to be happening. So Komsomolskaya Pravda, which is the successor to the old Pravda newspaper from Soviet times, they accidentally published for a brief period when it was at like 10,000. They accidentally published the real number and then they scrubbed it like 12 hours later because the Ministry of Defense had released the number. So I think that they know, I think that the Russian government knows, but they took that down immediately. So I think the Russians really don't think it's that many soldiers. The irony of propaganda is that though, if you go to Komsomolskaya Pravda, the front page news almost every day is about Russian soldiers who've been killed. So kind of like human interest sympathy stories about, look what they did to our Russian soldiers, look what they did, but they haven't killed that many of them, don't worry, we're being successful, but look what the Ukrainians have done. So I don't think that Russians think that number is that high, unless they're really looking at alternate news sources. You can still use a VPN in Russia to get around internet restrictions. You could read Western news sources, but most people are not doing that.
I don't remember the numbers, but some crazy percentage of the Russian military is headed to Ukraine right now.
Yeah.
And it's just growing. Is Russia at all concerned about Georgia and places that they've already subdued? Are they worried about that?
Well, they might be worried, but I don't think there's much they can do. I think they are stretched to capacity. So there's concerns that they'll go into Moldova and take Transnistria, which has been a longstanding, like there's a lot of ethnic Russians there. I think they would if they could. I'm cautiously optimistic that they're at capacity right now for places to take over. They do in Abkhazia and South Abkhazia. So we might see that those regions try to take advantage of the situation or that the Georgian government tries to get those territories back. I haven't heard anything about that recently, but it's totally possible. Yeah. 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 So the Russian government would love to have the capacity of the Chinese government to control the internet, and they just do not have the capacity. So they have banned certain websites. They've banned, you can't call it a war in Russia. You have to call it a special military operation. And so some independent private sources that are trying to function in Russia, which are very limited now, but like I'll talk about the Levada Polling Agency in a moment, they'll put it in quotations. They'll say special military operation. They don't use the word war because they get shut down if they did that, but they say special military operation. So you can't use the word war. They're trying to crack down on certain sources. A lot of foreign media doesn't have on the ground reporting in Russia anymore. A lot of those people have left. So the Moscow Times is an English language news source from Russia that provided independent news from Russia that wasn't state influenced. Most of their journalists or all have left Russia. They've stopped their live on the ground coverage from Russia. Their website is still up, but they're compiling news from other sources about the war because they're calling it a war in the Moscow Times. The other thing is that in addition to these soldiers killed, something like 300 some of the officer class have been killed. So the leadership of the Russian military is decimated. And this is a tremendously underprepared. They've got lots of weapons and not enough people. And the weapons they sent into Ukraine initially were not their best, it looks like. I think it appears that they genuinely thought this would be easier than it has been. Yeah.
Can you talk about the capacity of the Ukrainian army? I mean, for military, I don't know much about the region, but I would just think Russia would crush that. And is it a Western war?
Yeah. So I'm not a military expert, and I'm going to start with that. But my understanding of the coverage of it is that the Ukrainians were able to impose enough losses, and the Russian forces did badly enough that it didn't make sense for Russia to continue. But also, Ukraine is getting tremendous military support from other countries. And so they're getting things like surface-to-air missiles that can shoot down planes that can sink the ship that they sunk, right? That can be quite effective without having to have huge numbers of people fighting. So the weaponry is enormously helpful, is keeping them in the game. There's 40 countries right now that are providing military aid to Ukraine. So.
Yeah. Does that tie into anything? I know there's been commentary articles, so is that a deliberate jump to 2022?
It wasn't deliberate so much as I just was, I don't know. I was trying to... So do you mean the 2020 in the U.S.?
In the U.S.
Okay. Right. I guess I subconsciously did intentionally skip over that. So I guess I would have to think more about how I would want to answer something like this, but I have thought about sort of the alternate reality of if Trump had gotten reelected, what this would look like. And I think it would look vastly different, and it would be Europe probably leading the efforts to help Ukraine, and not the United States leading the efforts with Europe, the United States with Europe, because Europe is very much so in the forefront of helping Ukraine right now. And so the things about withholding aid to Zelensky, it's just such a totally different foreign policy that we saw from the Trump administration to the Biden one, that I think that's all I'll say. I think I'll stop there. Just because I don't think that was the groundwork for this necessarily. Like, I don't think Putin saw that and thought, I'll invade because that's happening. And then certainly after Trump loses, so there's the impeachment hearings and then Trump actually loses. But
I remember hearing that Zelensky, when one of the reasons it was so surprising that he stayed was that, I think this is right, what I heard was that there were people in Ukraine who were concerned that he would be too Russia-facing. He would be too pro-Russia for the Western Russia. And it's turned out not to be the case.
Yeah. So I think that was more the concern when he was running for office. Okay. What's really fast, I'm glad you brought this up, because what's so interesting about Zelensky is he's from the eastern part of the country. He's a native Russian speaker. He speaks Ukrainian fluently, but he grew up speaking Russian at home and fluently. So he's a native Russian speaker. He speaks Ukrainian fluently and English fluently. So if you've watched, you've probably seen some of the interviews with him. He can seamlessly switch between Ukrainian, Russian, and English, depending on which audience he wants to be speaking to. And he does it strategically, as would be appropriate, to target certain audiences. And so there was, when he was running for office, Poroshenko, who was trying to run to get off again, would make fun of his Ukrainian a little bit, but his Ukrainian's very good. It's very fluent. By the accounts of native speakers that I've heard, Zelensky's Ukrainian is fine. But Poroshenko tried to play this up as like, look, he's got this Russian name. He's a native Russian speaker. Maybe he's too pro-Russia. And this turned out to not be an issue at all. And Zelensky's acting career, he'd mostly done primarily Russian language things. So Servant of the People that you can see on Netflix is in Russian almost entirely. I know. And so, but this speaks to, in Ukraine, how much the Ukrainian and Russian language is mixed. It really was largely not an issue. It's going to be more of an issue now. Zelensky's own staff on press releases had spelled his name different ways, the more Russified way or the more Ukrainian way. And so like Zelensky on his passport has the double Y, but his own press office has released like multiple. And so there was a concern about that, but less so, I don't think so much when the 2022 events of 2 months ago started. Poroshenko is still there fighting. Yeah, there's all these pictures of him geared up and he's got the gun. Yeah.
I don't want to mess up your flow.
No, go ahead.
I was curious about this slide in the 2004 election in the Russian-speaking area, Kherson, if I'm remembering right, looked like it was the closest, the weakest share, right?
So this, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
For Yanukovych.
Yeah.
Is there any reason to kind of suspect a connection between that and the fact that like if you listen to military experts today, they say that among those occupied Russian occupied territories in the east, Kherson might be the one of the weakest and one of the most susceptible to a Ukrainian counterattack.
Well, it probably is just based on geography. I mean, but yes, political support too, but those both sort of correspond because you can see in the furthest east ones, it's like more than 90% were for Yanukovych. In Crimea, it's really high, over 80%. But I would think just by, I mean, it might be, yes, because politically, maybe it wouldn't take much to sway them. But that's still like, I don't know, 11 percentage points is a lot. And Kherson, right, it's the 61.14. Yeah.
So, here.
Yeah.
Just for my, how big is this whole area? And then how big would maybe the blue part of that area? When they talk about how many hundreds of thousands are being hidden and how many soldiers are in there, I can't, like, is it the size of what state, maybe?
Oh, well, that's, so this is the, both sections are the whole country of Ukraine, which superimposed on a map of Europe territorially, like geographically, is like most of the geography of Europe. Like, it's a huge country, but a lot of it's agricultural. But it is a huge country, both in population and in landmass. I don't know what state to compare it to for the eastern part, like maybe Texas plus some? Texas plus some, maybe? Yeah. Yes, it is a very big... Right, they just show, that like the Donbass region and Crimea, right?
Sarah, yeah. We have a question.
I don't know exactly what state to compare. Oh, okay. Yes. What is the question?
Sure. From one of our listeners. Thank you, Professor, for a truly outstanding talk. This may be a silly question, but is it plausible that a reason Russian troops are underperforming is that they don't want to be there at all, feel it is entirely unjust, or otherwise don't believe the Kremlin propaganda?
Yeah, so that's not a silly question at all. And the answer is, I'm not sure if I give a really honest answer. There are anecdotal stories of Russian soldiers who are doing things like shooting out the tires of their own tanks. There was a story about maybe they ran over their own commanding officer, Russian soldiers defecting. So there are stories about that, but I really couldn't say how widespread that is. And it's very likely that most of the Russian soldiers are more or less okay with the Kremlin propaganda. Some may not want to be there. And there was a report that got widely circulated in news stories of they had a radio transmission they intercepted with a Russian soldier saying, I don't know who to shoot, they all look like us. Because they're Slavic and they're white. And so this isn't like when Russia was in Chechnya in the 90s and 2000s where they were Muslim and a different skin color and maybe it was easier to shoot them. And so some might be. And I would hope that the fact that they have linguistic and cultural and ethnic ties would maybe make them think, I mean, that is racism because they're more comfortable shooting maybe people that don't look like them, but maybe that would give them pause. Like, what am I doing here shooting these people that look like me? So I think there's some of it, but I don't think we have any evidence that en masse Russian soldiers are defecting. A lot of the conscripts in the Russian military are they're young, they're very young for one thing. If you're an actual conscript, you're probably 18, 19, 20 years old at most. And you're from poor regions and you don't have a lot of options. And so it might take a lot for you to defect because what are you gonna do? Maybe, but that's a very good question. Okay, I don't know if I answered your question about the size though. Yeah. Well, so I'll go on to what Russians think about the conflict. So I went in the wrong direction there. Oh, I'm still going in the, okay. Also, so what do Russians think?
We have a yes. question from, a real quick question from the audience. Follow-up question. Are the atrocities that have occurred, have been permitted, also a function of frustration on the part of Russian troops?
I think that they might be. I don't know that there's evidence of that, but I wondered the same thing when I heard about Bucha. And it seems like the Russian forces thought they would be able to take Kiev. They kept trying to take Kiev. They couldn't. They were frustrated by a very sustained and brave resistance from the Ukrainian people and from civilians. And I really wondered if part of why what happened in Bucha happened, where they were shooting civilians. I mean, they shot a man on his bike. There's pictures of a man with a sack of potatoes walking home who gets shot. I mean, these were not people who were a threat. If it wasn't just that they were angry, that they had to pull back. I don't know that, but I think it's entirely possible. The very difficult thing is that when there are these war crimes, it takes forever to hold people accountable, and many people who are responsible will not be held accountable. It's devastating. I mean, if you even look at like the war crimes from the former Yugoslavia, it took over a decade to hold people to account at The Hague. Or you can look further back at historical examples like the Holocaust. It took decades. And even then, they weren't able to hold everyone responsible. So, I mean, these are, I think, pretty unquestionably war crimes. But it will be very difficult to actually get justice for that. But there is a lot of documentation, so maybe there will be. Yeah, please.
I was thinking, isn't this similar to during the Vietnam War? I think it was My Lai, or what it was called. It was just American soldiers just massacring an entire town.
Okay.
And I think it was just frustration. A very similar case where one got sentenced, but he was pardoned after a year.
Wow.
So there was no really state any justice.
Yeah. No. So I'll pivot to talking about what Russians think about the war right now, which I think this is very surprising. I want to emphasize this is from before the war. This is December 2021. There had been this big nationally representative survey of Russians. And it did not look like Russians were calling for Russia to invade Ukraine. So it does not look like public opinion was pushing for this to happen, but they have gotten on the side of Putin. So in December 2021, and I would consider this reliable survey evidence, honestly, until February 2022, we had a solid at least 20 years of really reliable, sophisticated survey analysis coming out of Russia from independent polling agencies. I know that's surprising, and it's increasingly not true day by day right now in Russia, but we had reliable survey data from private polling agencies. And reliable data showed us that only about 8% of Russians thought that Russia should send military forces to fight the Ukrainian government in December of 2021. I have a very renowned colleague, John O'Loughlin, who's done a lot of survey work in Ukraine. And he likes to say, he likes to quote Mike Tyson and say, everybody's got a plan until they get punched in the mouth. So it's like, everybody thinks they know public opinion about the war until the war happens. And so this will change dramatically. But what's telling is that it does not look like public opinion was calling for Russia to invade, but they could get on board with the Kremlin propaganda once it happened. What is notable, though, is 75% thought NATO would try to weaken Russia if Putin didn't stand up to them. There is a long-standing NATO is out to get us. Now, to be fair, NATO is a post-World War II security organization that was initially created to counter the power of the Soviet Union. It serves a different function today, but this has been a long-standing issue for Russia in the 90s, in the 2000s. Concerns about NATO and NATO expansion and getting too close to its borders. But again, Ukraine was not, they wanted to preempt the possibility that Ukraine would ever think about getting into NATO. There were no NATO negotiations for Ukraine happening when they invaded. So what I want to point out, though, is Putin's approval ratings. And this is a private, reliable polling agency, very bravely still conducting research in Russia. Levada is the one that I said, like, they'll put special military operation in quotes, which is a clear nod to, like, we think this is nonsense, but, you know, we don't want to get shut down. That's Putin's approval rating on top, right before the 2014 invasion. It had tanked. Putin is used to, from the time he was, so he becomes acting president January 1st of 2000, because Yeltsin resigned early. He was prime minister as of August 99. So that's his approval as prime minister initially. But as president, Putin is used to having at least in the 70s, but preferably in the 80s. And there's some sophisticated survey analysis. It's called list experiments. It's how you ask people sensitive questions that they might have a bias to lie about. So they did survey list experiments to see if these numbers were real or people were just saying they liked Putin. These numbers might be inflated by about 10%, but that would still be really high genuine approval ratings. So when we get to, though, 2014, right before the 2014 invasion of Ukraine and takeover of Crimea, Putin had the lowest approval ratings he'd ever had. And then they shoot up right after he takes over Ukraine to a well over 80%, nearly 90%, actually, after he takes over Ukraine. That holds steady for a while. We have an 8-year war going on. It starts to decline right about 2018. Then we hit another low just before the 2022 invasion. Now, I'm not saying that Putin invaded Ukraine solely or even primarily to boost his approval ratings, but I think the second time around, he had a nice reason to think he could get people on board and that it might improve his approval, or at least that Russians were not going to punish him in the short term for it. Now, if this holds, when Russia's cut off from the international economy, the ruble continues to be at a very low value, you've got a lot of urban Russians in places like St. Petersburg and Moscow and other big cities that are used to a very cosmopolitan and certain kind of lifestyle. If he can sustain this level of support with a war, ongoing war against Ukraine, that's the question, is how long he can pull it off. But approval ratings tanked, he invades a country, and his approval shoots up. Levada, no, so this is interesting. They have a Russian language website and they have an English language website, and they always have, as long as they've had a website. But they publish different results in the Russian language one versus the English language one. Now, I mean, this is not, it's not like it's hard for the Kremlin to figure out the English language version, but I've got to think that there's something to why they're choosing what they choose. So the Russian version, they present this question, which is a kind of innocuous indirect question. Are you worried about events in Ukraine, which could mean anything, right? Like, are you worried Russia will lose? Are you worried that Russia will, you know, or it could mean you're opposed. And so here what we see is that 82% said they were, of the general population, said they were very or somewhat worried. And that's the dark blue and the light blue. And then it's got a breakdown by age groups. So you can see the 55 and older crowd are the most worried about, if just this generic question. If you're worried about it. And so younger people are reporting lower, but still high. I mean, it's 67% are very or somewhat worried about it. But then the question is, what does this mean, right? That you're worried about the war. And so if we go to the English language version, Levada has asked very directly, this is why I'm not sure how much longer they're going to be operating, do you support personally, and they would have done the survey in Russian, not in English, they're just reporting this in English. Do you personally support the actions of the armed forces of Russia and Ukraine? They've avoided the word war, but they've made it very clear what they're asking. And so the total is 53% yes. I think that's a reliable number. I think more than half of Russians probably do support strongly, definitely yes. Another 28% say rather yes. And so what they're seeing is a vast majority of Russians at this moment do back what Russia's doing. But again, they're seeing a completely alternate explanation. So when I've talked to Russians who are currently in Russia and Moscow, who are not academics, who are closer to the average Russian, they said, well, this is the US's fault. The US started this war. And I was like, this is gonna take me a second. Can you walk me through that? How that would have been? The US started this war. And their point is that the US encouraged NATO to expand, that the US was offering support, that the US and other countries, of course, because there's 40 countries around the world offering military aid to Ukraine, are fueling the conflict by giving weapons to Ukraine. And so this isn't Russia's fault. Russia's just trying to deal with a humanitarian crisis, that there's a genocide against ethnic Russians in Eastern Ukraine, which is a fiction, because Russia backed the separatist regions and the Ukrainian government tried to keep the territories. It's not the case that the Ukrainian government was targeting ethnic Russians. And even like the Russian government likes to blur the line between native Russian speaker and ethnic Russian, because they'll say Russian speakers, but you could be a native Russian speaker and ethnically Ukrainian, like Zelensky, like lots of people in Ukraine. Most people do support it, but we see higher support in the older generations than the younger ones. And depending on the situation, younger people are more likely to protest. It really depends on the issue. Actually, older people in Russia have been some of the biggest protesters because of when they changed. I write about pension politics in Russia. So like when they change pension deals, if they try to cut back on pensions, older people in Russia really can get out on the streets and the government's a little bit less likely to arrest and kill them. So depending on how this plays out and who supports it or not, maybe we see public opinion turn. Yeah, I think they have that on the website. I don't have it here. I don't know if they break down urban versus rural. I'm sure they have the data, but I don't think that they've published it on the website, that breakdown, but I would have to double check. If you do want to see the slides, I'll put the link up again at the end. I've embedded links to all of this in the slides, so you can pull all the websites up for yourself. And the Russian language ones, Google Translate does an okay job translating those.
What's your sense, though? Is it likely to see less support for in rural and rural areas or more support?
Probably more support in rural areas and less in urban areas that are more connected to the global economy, more cosmopolitan. They're seeing businesses leave. They're seeing more changes to their daily lives. So urban, almost certainly, is where you're going to see more dissent against it. But it's still not a huge number. And it's notable that a lot of the people that were most opposed to the war in Russia, if they were able to leave Russia in these past 2 months, they may have already done so. And so like a lot of my colleagues, which is not the average Russian, but like, or the average person, both because they're in urban areas and they're a little financially better off and they're academics and we're a rare group anyways, but those people have left the country. And so people who are opposed have left, which means you've got the people who've stayed either don't care or they support it. So. Sanctions don't usually work, but these are unprecedented sanctions and that they're at the governmental level and they've cut Russia off from its foreign currency reserves. And so one of the things I have on a later slide is that Russia is currently in selective default on a lot of its debt. And if they continue to not have access to their foreign reserves so they can pay their debt in dollars, especially, they will eventually go into full default. But Russia, their foreign debt is low for a developed country. It's only about 17% of their GDP. So their foreign debts were 17% of their GDP. Countries like the UK, Germany, the US typically have foreign debt worth more than 100% of their GDP. I mean, that's not a problem because they're not going to default. Like the only issue is if you're going to default. Although economists do disagree on what the upper limit should be. But so Russia had already made attempts to insulate itself from the global economy. So to some extent, they can weather those sanctions for a while. It's kind of like this like game of, I don't know, chicken or a war of attrition or something where both sides are waiting out how much cost they can impose on the other side before the other one gives. So like Russia cut off gas to Bulgaria and Poland. That's bad, but Europe can cover that for now. They cut off gas to Germany, though. That starts to get pretty dire. If Europe can figure out a way to pivot from energy dependence on Russia, Russia loses a huge source of leverage. But that's a big if. And so that's the game with sanctions right now. They could work, and these are at an unprecedentedly big level, the sanctions they have right now. And over the next decade, if they stay in place, it will hurt the economic conditions in Russia domestically. People that are used to doing better than they are going to be doing worse. They'll have higher inflation. Russians are used to, especially in urban areas, are used to being able to travel and do things. They're not going to be able to do that as easily anymore. So eventually that could turn public opinion. The question is how long that would take and how long the Russian government can insulate itself from the costs of these sanctions.
Excuse me, yes. Professor. Oh, sorry.
Yeah. It's a really good question. And so there was some work done in the mid to like 2010s, right around 2010, that seemed to suggest that Russians knew a lot of it was Kremlin-backed and Kremlin propaganda, but they thought that they could kind of weed out the truth, the fact from fiction. They thought that they were smart enough to figure out the fact from fiction. So they're like, yeah, we know the Kremlin is portraying this certain view, but we think we can figure out what's really happening versus what's not based on what we're hearing. And so if you're not a person that's very politically engaged, is really interested in diving deep into things, you hear the news and take in the news, and you're not going to go out of your way to find other sources that disprove what you already think is likely true. And so it's not that they don't think there's propaganda, but it's probably that they think they can figure out what the truth is. And they're already suspicious of NATO, and not necessarily always suspicious of Westerners, but suspicious of Western foreign policy. And so they'll buy some of the stuff like NATO's out to get us. Oh, sorry. Okay, and two in Zoom. Okay, so yes, I'll do maybe one here, because you had your hand up before.
Yeah, mention of NATO. Obviously, your slide there demonstrated that was the focal point of the Russians themselves in the view here. And I was struck by your earlier comment that you thought NATO had changed its posture or something over the life of its, over its life, especially prior to, obviously, February 24th. And on how NATO has somehow changed here and its impact on what's happening.
So after the Soviet Union dissolved, in principle, NATO was not just focused on constraining Russian power. When NATO was initially created as a North Atlantic Treaty Organization, it was seen explicitly as a way to counter Soviet power. But when the Soviet Union ceased to exist, NATO took on a different scope and sort of span. Now, the Russian government said, well, that's nice, but we don't buy it. We still think that NATO is, you know, it's sort of this Europe versus Russia. Although in the 1990s with Yeltsin, that was a bit different, that dynamic. So Yeltsin was much more pro-Western than Putin ever was. And so Yeltsin was more tolerant of things, not thrilled about it probably, but tolerant of things like the Baltic countries getting into NATO and being part of it. Whereas Putin really was not. So it's sort of the central goal of NATO shifted somewhat with that, but that was very difficult to convince people who did Russian foreign policy from a Russian perspective that that was actually the case. And maybe for very good reasons, right? That there were good reasons for them to be cautious about that. But for that to be a reason to invade Ukraine is of course, not the case. Yeah, that's right. I don't think that they did change it. Right.
Totally defensive and almost
right.
Optional defensive organization at the country level.
Right.
So I'm really struck by Russia's so hung up, if you will, on NATO as the boogeyman.
I think it's a convenient boogeyman. And I think it's one they can point to rally people around a kind of anti-Western foreign policy. What's so interesting about this is Putin has achieved what no European power ever could, which is like Finland might join NATO. Like that wasn't even on the table before. Yeah. Like Putin has accomplished unifying Europe. I mean, Putin's accomplished what I never thought was possible in Ukrainian politics, which is unifying Ukrainian politics. I mean, this is a deeply polarized country, but he took the parts of the country that were most opposed, like Crimea, out. Donbass, we'll see what happens with him, but he unified the Ukrainian politics. I mean, that's remarkable. That was not it, but it's more like Putin has created the world he sought to create. It was a self-fulfilling prophecy that he made NATO into an organization that is anti-Russian. There are some people who I've heard very cynically speculate that the West doesn't mind if the Donbass conflict continues because it ties up Russia and weakens Russia. I don't think I would agree with that at all. But there are some people who cynically think like, well, they're okay with a low-level conflict there if it ties up the Russian military and Russia can't go into Georgia or can't go into Moldova or maybe can't engage in some other big conflict. I that's not my sense of what's happening, but there are people that speculate that.
I just have a related question about NATO. We've been hearing a lot about Sweden possibly wanting to join NATO.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if And I mean, I can sort of guess what Putin thinks, but the Russian people, are they worried about Sweden and Finland? Do they even know that there's been this, you know, this
news? We have a Swede in the audience.
Yeah. I, okay. Yeah. I think that some Russians who are paying attention to the news likely know at some level that they're, like, my guess, if I had to, if we did a survey, is that somewhere between 15 and 25% are aware. That's my, I'm totally guessing with that number. But there's probably some small percentage that are paying attention to that and know that those countries are thinking about joining NATO. The Russian media is reporting on all of this, just alternate reality versions. So did you want to chime in or?
Yeah, I just wanted to say it's a big question in Sweden. And it's because Russian officials have issued warnings to Finland and Sweden that military action is expected if they join NATO or.
Which they're going to threaten a way. It just doesn't make, yeah.
I don't know. I'd be more worried if I was Finnish.
Yeah, because they're right there.
Yeah.
And that's where people were. So the train from St. Petersburg to Helsinki, the prices shot up to that seventh. It was thousands of dollars to get a seat on those trains out of Russia for a period of time. I'm not sure what the status of that is now, but yeah, that was one route out. But. Yeah.
Excuse me?
Yeah, I should do the Zoom questions and then come back if that's okay. Oh.
I just wonder. There's an island in Sweden called Gotland. It's very strategically important for Russia. So there's a lot of questions going around with ships going into Swedish.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So maybe something there.
Yeah. All right. So there were a couple of questions on Zoom.
Well, no, there's only just one. And the question is, can you speak to the role of the oligarchy in Russia vis-a-vis support for the war?
Yeah, this is a really good question. So for the most part, most of the oligarchs have not vocally opposed the war, with a couple of notable exceptions. And there was a recent oligarch who opposed the war, the Russian government essentially seized his assets. They didn't seize it, but they bought his assets in what was kind of a fire sale. So he was forced to sell a great deal of his property after posting on, I think it was Instagram, his opposition to the war. Most Russian oligarchs are not vocally speaking out against it, precisely because they're concerned about it. There's oligarchs like Roman Abramovich, who is based in the UK, who was forced to sell, Manchester United he owned? In the football team. I don't follow European football very much. So it was Manchester United he owned. He was forced to sell that by the British. And Roman Abramovich, he went to some kind of peace talk. He sent himself to a peace talk and maybe got poisoned or something. And so he doesn't live in Russia and he's vocally opposed it. So he's more insulated. The oligarchs should be mad about this and likely are, because their children often study abroad in elite foreign universities. They're very globally connected. They can't speak out because they risk their assets being seized, but their businesses have been potentially irrevocably harmed by this. And so one speculation was about what about a coup? And I don't think that that's likely. I don't think we're seeing signs of that right now in Russia. And I'm not sure we would want that, because you don't know who the coup would be. Coups are inherently unstable and not, they don't always result in good things, even if Putin is really bad. But that was one speculation, is maybe these oligarchs would rise up. But Putin has created a pretty strong culture of fear. He centralized power. There are not opposition activists that are free, for the most part, to organize things. Navalny, of course, is still in prison and is being brought up on additional charges. They've cracked down pretty well before. It's going to take a lot for there to be either a coup or a popular uprising. I'm not saying, and after it happens, everyone will say it was inevitable, but everyone said that when the Soviet Union ended, everyone was no, it's going to be forever. And then it ends and everybody said, oh, I knew it. It was inevitable. And it's okay. So if it happens tomorrow, I'm preemptively saying we didn't know, but, yeah. Did you have a question in the back?
Yeah, I was curious. Justification of Russia.
No, it didn't magically appear. I mean, we see the most recent iteration of it we saw was back in 2014 when Yanukovych was forced to flee the country. They came up with this narrative that the pro-European Ukrainians are oppressing the other side. So it's you've got two sides in Ukraine and one side is oppressing the other side, and that forcing Yanukovych to flee was an illegitimate political coup. It was not democratic. and that they were oppressing people in the East. So that's the most recent version of it. I have to be honest, I'm not sure if historically they had put up the sort of Ukrainians oppressing ethnic Russians. The other part of the sort of fictional historical narrative that Putin has come up with is Ukraine was always part of Russia, so it should be part of Russia again. But you've got to go back hundreds of years, even thousands, for that to be true. And there is historically, a very long time ago, Kievan Rus was sort of where the Rus people were that became modern sort of Russia. Although I'm pretty sure if you're going with that narrative, that's a reason Ukraine should take over Russia, not the other way around. But I don't think Putin likes that interpretation. But that's what he's using to come up with this. I will say too, there's rumors and speculation about Putin's health and that maybe he's like a little like off his rocker. And that's part of the reason for this, but he's likely also been fed misinformation about how easily they could win and what's happening and that kind of thing. The health things, I mean, it's honestly, it's like we're back in criminology, or like they used to call it, it's like criminology, where you would like, Sovia tells you what criminology, where you would like look at who was lined up a certain way on Lenin's tomb during events. And you'd be like, okay, that person seems like they're out. They're standing a little bit behind. This person used to be closer. This person's front. And now it's like Putin's hand is shaking. Maybe he has Parkinson's. Like this is the level of political analysis we're stuck with because it's so close that like, they're like, well, he looks like he's a little bloated and his hand's shaking. And so we're like diagnosing medical conditions on this. But I don't know. I veered off course there a lot from your question, but yeah.
I just wanted to add, I think that's a popular, like, cast spell, like, recent war. This, like, the other side are genociding our people.
Yeah, yeah.
I think Hitler did the same prior to World War II.
Milosevic did the same thing in Yugoslavia. He said Serbs are at risk. We need to go in and kill everyone. He didn't say we need to go in and kill everyone, but he said we need to go in and defend the Serbian people. And then what he did was go in and kill everyone. So, I think with the Tigray in Ethiopia right now, there's a similar. And so there's a genocide that's been going on in earnest for at least the past 2 years during the pandemic in Ethiopia against the Tigray people in the north. And things like that don't get any attention with the conflict in Ukraine. And I'm not saying people should pay less attention to this, but I do understand when people say we can't forget these other things, bad things, genocides that are going on, real genocides that are going on. Some people, so in international law, genocide is uniquely hard to prove. Like you can prove war, my understanding is you can prove war crimes more easily than actual genocide. And so there is a bit of a debate now about if what Russia's doing to Ukrainians should be called genocide or war crimes. So I don't think I need to go necessarily through the rest of this. I mean, I've got some more up here and I'll put the link so that you can look at this. There's reasons why that people say, why don't you support the actions for those who said they didn't? It's people who are maybe pacifists or against civilians dying. It's a different country, we shouldn't interfere. You'll notice a really low rate of response for those who are opposed. The wars against our own kin. Small percent say we initiated it, yeah. Yeah. About the threat of nuclear war. So a lot less so. But what I'll also say is Putin loves to pull out the, we have nuclear weapons card. Like he's done that periodically, which it's still a very big concern because of course, any use of nuclear weapons would be extremely, extremely bad. But Putin does, and Lavrov as well, Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister, have a history of sort of hinting, they're like, oh, don't forget we have nuclear weapons and you know maybe you don't wanna mess with us. I'm cautiously optimistic that I don't think they actually want to use nuclear weapons. For one thing, I don't think they're in a position to sustain any kind of counterattack. Their military is already stretched very thin. I don't think that they actually want that. And once they use them, they lose the threat then of losing them. So I think it's in their advantage to threaten to use nuclear weapons and not so much use them. I think, you know, people used to talk about, they talk about it less now, but especially in the 90s and before, people talked about mutually assured destruction, even like actually decades before that, that both sides have nuclear forces that could destroy each other, and having these nuclear weapons ensures that no one uses them. Now that's, you know, in the 90s, a lot of progress was made with denuclearization, so decommissioning nuclear weapons. But for a long time, the idea was that mutually assured destruction, which does exist between Russia and the US. I mean, both have nuclear weapons and can destroy each other, which I think is a reason to be cautiously optimistic. But if Putin's like out of his mind there, I think there's a real concern that they could use them. But it's getting a lot less coverage in Russia, the threat of nuclear attack.
I think the only thing I would add to what Sarah mentioned, just from stuff that I've picked up, is that there is a class of Russian thinker in the kind of the intelligentsia and the intellectual circles of Russia that looks at the isolation, that might even look at a military defeat with a lot of glee, who actually is looking for Russia to be contained and cut off and to be more Russian thereby. So it's perhaps an eccentric strain of thought in Russia.
There was another question.
Since you mentioned nuclear weapons and the history that you've gone through here, Ukraine, I was interested in your take as well on the agreement that was made when Ukraine gave up its nuclear weapons to Russia. That was a memorandum or what mm-hmm. it was called. It wasn't a treaty, obviously. We never ratified it, but the UK and US and Russia, if I understand, guaranteed Ukraine security. How that
yeah.
actually kind of forgotten
along the way. Zelensky has tried hard to remind people of that. So in 1996, Ukraine gave up its nuclear weapons in return for guarantees of safety if it were ever attacked. So if it were ever attacked, it said, we give up our nuclear weapons. And these other powers, so the US, the UK especially, promised to defend Ukraine if that happened. The question, so what Western advisors have sort of skirted the issue largely. What some commentators have said is they should have never reasonably expected that anyone was going to go to war for Ukraine, even though they gave up their nuclear weapons. Maybe that's a very cynical view of what happened. And I think NATO would say, well, NATO as an organization would say, we're fulfilling our obligation by providing military support and military aid. We're just not sending troops. And we're not going to declare a no-fly zone over the country because that would effectively be a declaration of war, and we don't want a direct war with Russia. But they've just sort of avoided the issue. But it absolutely was an agreement in the mid-1990s that they would give up their nuclear... They were because, yeah, Ukraine gave the weapons to Russia. Like, that's where the nuclear weapons went. Yeah. No, NATO was not a party to it. But I think that's right. So not NATO would say it's fulfilling its obligations, but the West would say we're fulfilling our obligations by providing weapons. Because I don't think that agreement specified what it meant to defend Ukraine if it were attacked. In which case, it's like a lot of international law. It's not binding. It's very hard to enforce. So I think Zelensky's right to bring it up and to rally all the support he can. But I would agree that I don't think anyone realistically thought it meant that people wanted to go to war in Ukraine or send troops. I don't know that that's right, but I think that's where it stands.
Any scenarios on how this all ends?
No, I wish I did have one. I think in the short term, the best we could hope for is a ceasefire, not a full-on peace agreement. Right now, the overlap between what Russia would accept and what Ukraine and what Western countries would accept is not very big. So I think a peace treaty, a full-on peace treaty and sort of permanent resolution is a long ways off. In the short term, It would be great if they could figure out a ceasefire situation. I mean, but it, so look at the difficulty even evacuating people from Mariupol, which I have a map in here somewhere of, I think Mariupol's on this map. Yeah, it is. So Mariupol's in the Donetsk region. And so they finally, after like weeks of attacking Mariupol, are starting to evacuate civilians from there. And they haven't even, that's not even a ceasefire. That's just like getting the civilians out. So I would hope in the short term, I think the most realistic, like this year, would be some kind of ceasefire, an agreement to have talks. And they sort of have had some talks during this, but not, it doesn't appear that Russia has any serious intention of negotiating. Russia didn't even stop bombing or attacking during the talks with the Ukrainian side. So a ceasefire, I think, has to be a prerequisite for there to be serious talks. I think very sadly and unjustly, Crimea will likely not go back to Ukraine for quite a long time. I don't think that's on the table. I think that what the Russian military advisors and what Putin are likely hoping for now is to secure Russian control of Luhansk and Donetsk, maybe to make them part of the country. They haven't actually said that yet. So even a couple months ago, there's this tape of Putin's advisor very nervously not saying quite the right thing about the invasion of Ukraine. And he's up there and Putin's like, what do you mean? What are you saying? You think it's a good idea or it is a good idea? Or you think it, like he's going, and at one point this man gets so nervous that he says, oh, I think Luhansk and Donetsk should be part of Russia. And Putin goes, what are you talking about? We're not talking about making them part of Russia yet. They're just, we want them to have their independence. And the guy goes, okay, that's what I mean. And so they might want to actually acquire them as part of Russia, but I think they at least want to establish that Ukraine does not control them. And right now, I don't think that's a negotiating point for Russia. So that's going to be, maybe they could be semi-autonomous regions and the two sides could reach an agreement about that. They should be part of Ukraine. Russia should not control them. But maybe that allows some sort of long-term settlement. I think there's realistically, professionally, I don't have a reason to be optimistic that this fighting ends soon.
Can you speak to, I was just going to say, can you speak to the May 9th anniversary? They're planning this big.
Oh, like the World War II yeah. victory
yeah.
in Russia?
Yeah.
You mean,
was,
yeah.
Was that one of some big wins before May 9th?
Well, they could just make up a big win, but which they've essentially already done. But so World War II memorials are so a very big deal in Russia. Yeah, that could be the case. They probably do want either some sort of like real thing they can point to or exaggerate as a victory for May 9th. But they'll do it either way. I don't think it has to be grounded in reality very much, unfortunately. Oh, for Russia? Yeah, I think there's a risk of that. If the fighting continues, because they won't have enough people. And that's why some people were eager to get out of Russia when this started and to get their, especially if they had sons of conscription age, to get them out right away before they closed the borders, which was is still a real possibility, I think, and or made it harder at least for people to leave, maybe not full on close the borders. But yeah, I think a full conscription is absolutely possible. What's happened with the, so Russia's always had a mandatory conscription in the post-communist era, but you could get exemptions for higher education. So they could just end the higher education exemptions. That would be one route and get more people. And there's always been a lot of corruption surrounding it. So there's like unofficial prices for what you buy to get the certificate that says you already served. So like you can buy your way out of it or you can get a higher education exemption, which is why the people that actually get conscripted in Russia are from poor regions without other options who can't get out of it. Not entirely, but that's a lot of the people that are conscripted. Yeah. Is there another, did you have a question?
Well, I think it was today there was another attack in Odessa, so it seems like starting in the West was there,
So I don't have any special insight into that, but Odessa is very strategically important, which you can guess from where it is on the map there, right on the Black Sea. There was some bombing near Lviv, although I think that has stopped. I could not swear to that. And so I'm not surprised that there has been a renewed push for Odessa. In a way, I mean, this feels very odd to say that I hope they stay in the East. I hope Russia leaves altogether. But I think the best case scenario is that they stay in the East. And then I think the danger is, and this is why I'm grateful that you're all here, the danger is that in the West, people are like, oh, okay, it's just a territorial conflict now. And there's a real danger that the Russian propaganda leaks into Western sources enough that it's sort of like, oh, there's two sides to it. The Ukrainians say one thing, the Russians say another thing. Well, maybe they should both compromise. When in fact, this is purely Russian aggression against Ukraine. But you know, and Russia targets some of its propaganda to the West. That's why we have RT.com, which I don't recommend reading. But you can. I mean, it's still up. You can still, unlike in Russia, you don't need a VPN here to read Russian propaganda. In Russia, to read the Western side, you need a VPN so you can get around the internet censorship. But here, I mean, you can go to Komsomolskaya Pravda. It's kp.ru. You can use Google Translate and see what it says. You can go to rt.com. Again, I don't recommend it. And actually, I do have somewhere in here, I have suggested things to read, which I can email as well because Electra was asking me about that. There it is. It's a very truncated list, but there's a couple English language Ukrainian newspapers. The Moscow Times is still up, but most of the reporters have left as best I can tell. And they don't have live country of the conflict anymore. There's a really good book from 2015 about the initial conflict, anything by Andrei Korkov, who is, he writes in Russian and Ukrainian, but his novels are mostly in Russian, but in, yeah. Or his adult novels are mostly in Russian. He had this, he writes everything. He writes commentaries, op-eds, does interviews. But he wrote a series called Death and the Penguin. There's three of them. It's been a while since I read it. But it's a journalist in Kyiv who gets hired to write obituaries and realizes it's actually like a hit list for the mafia because he's writing obituaries of people before they die. They're like giving the, and he rescues a penguin as part of it. That's why it's Death and the Penguin. It's very dark, but it's very good. But anything by him, these are good places to start. So, oh, there's another question. Yeah. Dugin's a Russian nationalist, and he's like, he's really right. out there. Yeah, that he's read. Yeah. 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 So I think there's something to this, that the Russian imperialism and wanting to bring it back. And so I've been paying attention to Russian politics for more than 20 years, but really seriously for the past 20 years. And honestly, I spent most of the 2000s trying to convince people that Russia was a safe place to go and it was good and there was Moscow was modern, it was great. And then in the past 2 months, that has all been destroyed, but only in the past 2 months. And it can change for sure. There was a Russian political scientist who her name escapes me now. I just read this the other day, but she was essentially explaining what has happened as Putin is, she had a much better way of putting it than I'm going to put it. But it's like he wanted a time machine. It was the time machine theory that he wanted to turn back the clock to this, like he sees time slipping away and he sees this new Russia that's integrated and that's not an imperial Russia. And he is from a very different era. He did start his career as a mid-level KGB agent, probably truly a mid-level KGB agent. And he came up through St. Petersburg politics. And then Yeltsin brought him to Moscow because he proved to be very loyal to Sobchak in St. Petersburg. He becomes the head of the FSB, which is the successor to the KGB. And then when he's appointed prime minister and then president, he was largely unknown in Russia and in the larger world. He'd been off the radar. He'd never run for office, Putin, before he become the president or prime minister. And so I do think there's something to this returning to this vision of Russia that he has. And maybe, I don't like to speculate too much about like the personality traits and his mental well-being, but maybe there is something to he if there's this like level of paranoia and specific image of Russia that like, I'm going to crush Ukraine. I'm going to take it. It deserves to be ours. I don't care if Russian public opinion is behind me, although they do seem to have a rally around the flag effect right now. But it doesn't appear the Russian public was calling for this. They've just rallied around it, right? The punch in the mouth changed everything. There does seem to be something to Russia. Putin has this different concept of the world, where Russia should be and what it should be. And it maps on to these illiberal values and these like, so you really see like a lot of anti like, well, Western democracy, that's not for us. So for a long time, he referred to a special kind of Russian democracy, which means not democracy, but it was a special kind of Russian democracy for Russia, which involves not being democratic. So like anti-LGBTQ plus things, because that's all part of those crazy Western values and a tradition and the constitutional changes. So they just had a big constitutional referendum in 2020. Well, I guess that's 2 years ago now. It feels like forever. They affirmed that marriage is only between a man and a woman in their constitution. This was part of the amendments that they made to the constitution in 2020. So it all does seem to be wrapped in a different view of the world that's a liberal, that's anti-Western. And is Make Russia Great Again. So
there's also a really good podcast, probably not the only one here, but he does a revolution podcast, and this, the last one that he's finishing it now is the Russian
revolution. Oh, great.
Very long, but there are select portions of it that are specifically about Ukraine and some of the history between Ukraine and Russia. But it's, you know, that World War One.
Oh, of course. What is this?
Really hot off the press book.
I was just going to ask. So, besides sort of informing ourselves about all this, what can any of us do?
Oh, that's a really good question. I think supporting efforts to support development in Ukraine are going to be really important. So if the conflict stays in the east, there's the possibility of rebuilding the western part of the country, even though the conflict is still ongoing. And so I do think that it makes a difference to give money. There's a lot of good different organizations. I always think there's a trade-off between giving to the really big established ones that are going to have more administrative costs, so more of your money goes to the administrative costs, versus the really local on the ground ones, which are more flexible and immediate, but it's a little harder to know exactly what's happening with your money there. And there's a whole variety of efforts right now, but I do think giving to those credible and sort of vetted sources that are providing assistance to Ukrainian refugees is really enormously beneficial. But the paying attention part matters and contacting your elected officials. I think I'm probably kind of like preaching to the choir on this with an audience that comes to a talk like this, but calling elected officials is still actually, they record all of those.
Thank you for listening to this Nederland Community Library recording.